Well, it's good to see you this morning, and just a very great pleasure to be here. Before we turn to our subject for today, our office always sends all kinds of stuff with me, so let me tell you what's back there on that, whatever you call that three-sided thing there. Yes, I don't know. Well, it has probably a proper name.
We call it a kiosk.
A kiosk, okay. My office sent me with a little brochure on Covenant Seminary, one on the Francis Schaeffer Institute, which the seminary asked me to start there, though which I no longer direct. One of my colleagues, Luke Bobo, is the director, and is just a wonderful administrator. And then a little magazine we put out regularly called Perspectives. This particular one is not our most recent one. This one was written by one of our students who graduated a couple of years ago, called The Beauty of the Weak and Lowly, Reflections on Human Dignity. It's just a quite wonderful article on God's call to us to care for those who are hurting and broken in all sorts of ways. Our most recent one is actually an article I wrote on Tolkien. We have this Friday night lecture series we do at our local Borders bookstore, which God has used to reach out to many people who wouldn't normally come to church. And those talks we write up and print up from time to time in this little magazine called Perspectives. You're very welcome to help yourself to these. And there's a sign-up sheet there as well if you would like to get it. It's free of charge, so there's no subscription fee for it. And then there's a couple of other little cards about various things that are going on at the seminary and information about them. So you're welcome to help yourself to those things. One of the beautiful things that came out of that, are starting this Friday night at our local Borders bookstore, when we will give a talk on anything that we think might interest people out in the community. So we have a huge range of subjects. In a month or so, I'm going to be doing one on the Left Behind series. You know, they have sold over 40 million copies, those books. So we'll be talking about that. We've talked about Harry Potter, about Tolkien, Islamic terrorism, the ethics of spying. Can a Christian be a spy? All sorts of interesting subjects. On popular music, people like Marilyn Manson, and all sorts of different things. One of the interesting things that's come out of that is that they're now probably around the country, I would guess about 30 of these groups meeting in bookstores regularly. Many of our graduates have started these. We have no ownership of them. We just give them a list of things to do and not to do. You'll get thrown out of there very fast if you do the wrong things in a public setting like that. You obviously have to respect the context. But what Steve said at the beginning is quite right. You know, you of course support missionaries who are working all over the world, and God has called us to be His missionaries right here. He sent His disciples out to Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. Well, all of our churches have their own equivalent to that. Your Jerusalem is here in Tulsa, and your Judea is the United States, and your Samaria, I suppose, is all the different kinds of people who live right alongside you and the ends of the earth. And what your missionaries are doing that you support and pray for, what people like Doug and Masha were doing before they came back to the States, and what they will be doing when they go back to the Ukraine or wherever the Lord is going to send them. God calls you to be doing those things right here. It's not a different kind of task. And my what I want to talk about this morning is this question of our neighbors. What about the people around us? Who are they? What are they thinking? What do they think about us? And how are we to relate to them? What does it mean for us to be living faithfully as Christians who are sent by Christ into the world? That's really our theme for this weekend. Remember, I began last night with those words from John 17, where Jesus prays, "Father, as you sent me into the world, so I have sent them." And that is how you and I are to think about ourselves day by day. We are those whom Christ sends into this world. Last night we talked about the challenge of some of the barriers we face in reaching out to people around us, even talking to them, getting to know them, building relationships with them. And this morning I want to turn to ask the question first, who are my neighbors? Now, as we get going here, and I'll pray in just a moment to start off this session, but as we get going here, let me just say to you, please feel free to ask questions as we go along. I much prefer to communicate that way. You all know pastors and teachers well enough that any of us can talk forever once we get going. That's one of the professional hazards of this calling. But I would much prefer it if you interacted with me as we went along. So if I don't see your hand, just call out, you know, and I will stop at a convenient moment, not in mid-sentence, hopefully, but at a convenient moment and take your questions, comments, and so on as we go. I'd much prefer it if we could interact like that as we go along, because I don't know you yet, of course, apart from one or two of you, and you don't know me, apart from one or two of you, so we'll get to know each other much better, and we'll get more out of this if you start interacting. So please do feel free to do that. If you want to disagree with me passionately, it won't offend me in the slightest. I've spent much of my life working in Le Brie, and the fundamental sort of ground rule for the ministry of Le Brie that Francine the Schaeffer started is that there are no questions off limits. If God's word is true, then we don't have to be bothered by people's questions, objections, problems, doubts with what we're saying. We should be prepared to reflect on anything because what we believe is the truth, and if it isn't, it's not worth believing. So we should be prepared to talk about things. So please do feel free to interact with me, to disagree if you want to, but do that respectfully, as we said last night. Not for my sake, but for your sake. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we do pray that you will be among us this morning, and we know that's your promise, that you delight to dwell in the hearts and among the praises of your people. And we come to you this morning. We have cold hearts. We recognize that. And yet there is some part of ourselves that longs to praise you and to love you and to worship you and to walk in your ways. And so we pray that you will be pleased to dwell among us and to teach us from your word and by your spirit, and as we talk together, that we may grow into the likeness of your Son and grow in the desire to serve you in this world. We ask for Jesus' sake. Amen. Now I want to start with the question, who are my neighbors? And I suppose another way of thinking about this is to reflect on the pluralism or the diversity of the society in which we live. Now, here in the United States, we live in a setting which has historically been diverse, perhaps much more diverse than we often recognize. Now, diversity is not something which has just happened recently in the United States. Think of the great French commentator on life in America, one of the most perceptive commentators ever, who was writing about 170 years ago, Alexis de Tocqueville. His writings have just been recently republished. And I would encourage those of you who are interested in history to read him. He is just fascinating. But he wrote this about 170 years ago. America, he said, is a marketplace jamboree with amazing diversity striving for recognition. That was 170 years ago. But, of course, that diversity is much earlier. The original inhabitants of this part of America and the whole of this continent, of course, were what we now call Native Americans in their many, many tribes spread all across this land from Alaska right down to the southern tip of South America. When people started coming here from elsewhere, some of the first people to arrive in what is now the United States were the Spanish, coming across the Atlantic to the Caribbean and to Mexico and to South America, but also to Florida and to the Southwest. And a little later, the French coming also to Florida and Louisiana and all along the Gulf Coast and spreading up along the Mississippi on both sides as far north as St. Louis. And later, the French as well coming down from Canada along the Mississippi to as far south as St. Louis and, of course, much further west. And then also in the early 1600s, of course, people coming from Britain and settling along the East Coast and gradually moving inland, and people from many other parts of Europe as well, from Holland and from Germany and from many other places. And even before there were slaves being brought across the Atlantic from Africa, there were Africans as well. Among those early settlers in the 1600s. I've just been listening to some fascinating programs on the radio during Black History Month about some of those early Africans who were involved in settlements already in the early 1600s, coming from the East Coast and working with the British and the Dutch and the Germans and others who were coming over. From the 19th century onwards, of course, there was just a vast influx of people from other parts of Europe as well. Vast numbers of Italians and Irish people, and many, many more Germans, and, of course, many others. But in the 19th century, just a huge diversity of people coming here from many different parts of the world, along the West Coast, people coming from Russia and from China, settling all up and down the coast of Oregon and Washington and California, with trading ports there, people coming to fish there and to get otters and seals and many, many other reasons for coming. So our history has been one of extraordinary diversity, which has got more and more so all the time. If I think about St. Louis, where I live right now, it's a fascinating city. We have about, in the greater St. Louis area, about 4 million people, so it's not one of these enormous places like New York or Chicago or Houston or Los Angeles, which are incredibly diverse. In Los Angeles, for example, Los Angeles is about the second or third largest Korean city in the world. After Seoul and perhaps one other on the Korean Peninsula, Los Angeles has well over 1 million Korean people. That's just one small part of its population. And it's got vast other groups as well of people from all over the world. But St. Louis, of course, a much smaller, big city. But what's our population like in St. Louis? the biggest proportion of our population is German. Vast numbers of German people coming in the 19th century, though St. Louis was originally settled by the Spanish, of course the Native Americans first, and then the Spanish, and then the French. It became a French city, and then with the Louisiana Purchase, then increasingly diverse. But St. Louis is the biggest population group of German, about 40%. The second largest population group in St. Louis have Irish origin. The third largest group are African Americans, and then probably Italians, and vast numbers of other people too. Just in the last 10 years or so, we have a large number of Afghanis in St. Louis, lots of people from the former Yugoslavia, lots of Serbs and Croats and Bosnians. Just in the 15 years that I've lived there, we now have a burgeoning, very rapidly growing Hispanic population, as does every other American city. St. Louis has one of the largest Jewish populations of any American city, because we have in St. Louis is the place where Jews come from every other part of the world. Then they come to the United States and then go out from St. Louis to other cities all over the United States, so a very large Jewish population. We have lots of Koreans and Chinese and Japanese and Filipinos and many, many other kinds of people as well. So St. Louis is a very diverse city, but all American cities are like this, including small ones. It was fascinating to me. I come from southern England, from a rural community where there is very little diversity. Most of the people in the village where I grew up in Hampshire in the south of England hadn't been more than 30 or 40 miles away from where they were born their whole lives, except for a few of the men who had fought in the First or Second World Wars. Everybody else had basically lived there for generation after generation, and just like some of the more rural parts of this country, lots of inbreeding because of that, and all kinds of hereditary problems because of that situation. But where my wife comes from is completely different. She also comes from a rural community here in the United States. She comes from Central California. And when I first went there in 1967 and we were married, that Christmas in Central California, she grew up on a farm in a farming community. It was absolutely fascinating to me to see how different her rural setting was from mine. There where she comes from in Central California, at that time the largest population group were German Mennonites who had settled there, who had come from Russia, though they were German in ethnic origin, but they had lived in Russia and the Ukraine for many, many generations, escaping persecution in Germany and settling in Russia, and then coming over around 1900 and settling in Central California. But that was just one group. There were lots and lots of Mexicans and other Hispanics there, and today they're the largest population group in that area where my wife comes from. And then there were lots of Armenians as well, who had come to the States in the 1920s, fleeing from the genocide in Turkey. So a large Armenian population, lots of Koreans and Filipinos and Japanese and Chinese in the community. One of the towns there is Swedish, with a huge Swedish coffee pot for its water tower. And lots of Italians, and just on and on and on, just extraordinary diversity. It was so interesting to me, coming from the situation I did, to come to this rural farming community and to see this incredible diversity. So wherever we go in the United States, there is this kind of diversity. We could go around this room, even in what may at first sight look like a fairly monocultural setting, and we would discover that you came from all sorts of different national backgrounds from many different parts of the world. And every American city is like that. And increasingly, of course, our families are like that. It's not just somebody else, it's us. In my wife's family, for example, one of her brothers married someone of Scottish descent, one of them married a Mexican, and one married somebody who's Chinese. In our own family, our three sons, my youngest son's wife is English. I grew up in the church where I was a pastor in England. His wife, our second son's wife is Filipino. He met her when he was studying at UCLA in Los Angeles. Our eldest son's wife is from Marseille in the south of France, but her father was an African from southern Algeria, not an Arab, but an African. So in my family, we have extraordinary diversity. We have people from most of the continents on this globe, just in my immediate family. And increasingly, this is the way all of our families are. So we ask, who are my neighbors? Well, they are increasingly very diverse. If I were to look at my street, living in a typical suburban community in Western St. Louis County, it has extraordinary diversity on it, culturally, racially, ethnically. That's the society in which we live. God has brought the whole world to us next door, basically. That's what America is today, probably the most diverse population the world has ever seen. Now, that's just racially and culturally. What about religiously? America's also tremendously diverse religiously. That's much more true historically also than we often recognize. Many Christians think that this country has simply been basically Protestant since the Pilgrim Fathers came, but actually it hasn't simply been Protestant since the Founding Fathers came. At the same time as they came, there were, of course, the Spanish and French were settling southern parts and western parts of the country, and they were, of course, Catholic, quite apart from all the Native American religions that were already here. But today, of course, nobody could argue with the statement that America is extraordinarily religiously diverse. In fact, there is no question that this is the most religiously diverse society the world has ever seen. If I think about right where I teach at Covenant Seminary in St. Louis, let me just give you some idea of what exists around us. I suppose there must be at least 100 Protestant denominations of every possible kind, from Lutheran Reformed on one wing to every possible kind of charismatic and Pentecostal denomination, right, and everything in between, and probably 100 to 200 denominations. Nobody can count them because one of the things about our society, there are new ones starting every day. That tells us also something about the nature of our culture, which I'll come back to later. The problem with authority. So we readily start new churches all the time. As soon as we have a question about anything or somebody wants a little bit more power, that's what happens. But then, of course, we have a great range of Roman Catholics as well. St. Louis is a predominantly Roman Catholic city. Because its two largest population groups are German and Irish, it is a predominantly Roman Catholic city and has been for the last couple of hundred years. Many of those Germans, the majority of those Germans, were Catholic. A smaller proportion of them were Lutheran, and so we're one of the Lutheran centers in the United States. But we have lots of Roman Catholics and various other Catholic groups as well. We also have lots of Orthodox, Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox and Serbian Orthodox and so on. In addition, we have lots of Jews, as I said, because St. Louis is such a major Jewish community. Within 4 or 5 miles of the seminary where I teach, there must be at least 5 synagogues, large and flourishing synagogues. So a huge Jewish community right there, with Jews of every possible stripe, from Orthodox to Reformed and Liberal and many who are just simply very secular. But a large Jewish community. We also have lots of Jehovah's Witnesses, of course, as every American city does. The Jehovah's Witnesses have been growing very rapidly. They've basically tripled in size in the United States over the past 25 years. They're a rapidly growing group. Just down the road, less than a mile from the seminary, we have a Mormon temple, which was built about 5 or 6 years ago, the 50th Mormon temple in the world, very close to us. And of course, Mormonism started fairly near St. Louis before the trek out to Utah. But this big Mormon temple down our road, and many, many Mormon groups all over the St. Louis area. Mormons have been growing even faster than Jehovah's Witnesses. They have quadrupled in size in the last 25 years here in the United States. So they're growing very, very rapidly. We also have lots of Christian scientists in St. Louis, one of the major centers of Christian science. Just a mile or two from the seminary campus, the largest campus of any educational institution in the whole St. Louis area, university, college, seminary, school, whatever, is a Christian Science High School, which is very, very large and very prosperous. So a large Christian Science community. We also have a growing Muslim community in the St. Louis area. We have a Muslim temple. A large Muslim mosque about 4 or 5 miles from the seminary, which was just built 7 or 8 years ago. And there are a great range of Islamic groups in the St. Louis area, from extreme fundamentalism of the most radical kind. I had a young man come to my office about 3 years ago, just 6 months or so before 9/11. His parents called me in great distress. They weren't Christians, but they had got my name from somewhere and said, "We gather you're prepared to talk to people." And I said, "Yes, I like to talk to people. I don't make them all feel worthless sinners." And, she said, "Will you please meet with my son? You know, he has become a Muslim at university and is saying the most alarming things." And he was just a typical... from a typical suburban white St. Louis family. He had gone to Southwest Missouri State, and there he had been converted by a radical Islamist group. They exist on every college campus in the United States, basically. And just like many Christian groups, they seek to reach out especially to freshmen when they start, when they're feeling lonely. And so he had become a radical Muslim, and he was talking about assassinating the President of the United States and many other things like that, things that nobody would talk about today after 9/11. But it was this that alarmed his parents so much, and they wanted me to talk to him. And that was a very interesting conversation, as you can imagine. So we have lots of Muslims of many different kinds right around us. I've got to know quite well the leader of one of the local mosques because he runs a food store right near where I live. So I pop in to see him and we have all sorts of very interesting discussions. So we've got lots of Muslims, a growing number of Muslims. And in any really large American city like New York or Houston or Los Angeles, there are probably 50 Islamic mosques. So there are lots and lots of Muslims in the United States. We also have in St. Louis quite a lot of Hindus. We have a Hindu temple just 4 or 5 miles from the seminary, and there are several others in the St. Louis area as well. Some of our closest personal friends in St. Louis are a Hindu family. We get invited to their home for meals more often than by anybody else we know. They're very, very hospitable, just very gracious and kind people, and we have got very close to their family. My wife had lunch with the wife last Saturday. So we have this extraordinary religious diversity all around us. And then there are all sorts of New Age groups of every kind as well. And this is just the beginning. Now again, this isn't only in our big cities. This kind of religious diversity, and of course about 40% of the people who claim no religious affiliation whatsoever, these are the people all around us. Every community is like this. These are our neighbors. This is who lives around us. These are the people we're going to meet in our grocery stores, in our workplaces, that our children will meet at school, that are coming to our colleges. We think we're going to send missionaries to the other side of the world to reach Jews, Hindus, Muslims, whatever. Well, actually, everybody's right here. That's the way it is, actually. So an extraordinary diversity culturally, racially, ethnically, religiously, however we want to think about it. Those are our neighbors, the people whom God has set right next door to us. Now, if you've got questions, you know, before I move on to my next point here, this would be a good place. Not that I've said anything controversial at the moment, but...
are you aware of what race the population
is? Yeah, most of the... That's a good question. It's difficult to get figures, obviously, because many Muslims, just like many people who are nominally Christian, are completely nominal and totally secular. But the figures are probably something like about 4 million Muslims in the United States. Most of the growth there is by immigration. There have been large numbers of Muslims coming from North Africa, Arabs from North Africa, and also Africans who are Muslim from North African countries and Central African countries, because Islam goes down basically as far as Nigeria and across to Tanzania in terms of its spread southwards in Africa. So many Arabs and Africans from North and Central Africa who are Muslim, many Arabs from the Middle East, many people from countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh, and Indonesia. Indonesia is actually the most populous, the largest Muslim country in the world, which may surprise some of you to hear that. You know, the center of Islam in terms of population is much further east than North Africa or where Islam started in Arabia. And Muslims from places like Bosnia and that part, those parts of southern and eastern Europe, and Muslims from parts of the former Soviet Union, from places like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and so on, if you look on your maps there. So yeah, we have Muslims from many, many different places. So the great majority of Muslim growth in the past 25 years to about the 4 million that there are now has come through immigration, but there are a significant number of conversions to Islam. As I mentioned in that story a few minutes ago, you know, on most university campuses there are Islamist groups that are seeking to convert people. The other place where there have been many conversions to Islam is our prisons. Most prisons have Islamic groups that are reaching out to the young men who are in prison there. Just as there are Christian ministries like Prison Fellowship, there are Islamic ministries as well. And for many of those young men who become Muslim for the first time in their life, they have something to live for, something which is going to provide them some kind of moral framework, some kind of accountability. So there's been a significant number of conversions to Islam in that setting. But having said that, the growth of Islam in this country is primarily by immigration rather than by conversion, unlike, say, the Mormons, where the growth is by conversion to Mormonism or to the Jehovah's Witnesses. Yes?
What constitutes a militant Muslim?
Mm.
They have
the
same Quran.
Mm. That's a good question. What constitutes a militant Muslim? Well, what I'm going to say now is very important. It is extremely important that when you think about Islam or when you talk about Islam, you do not assume that everybody is militant, that everybody is like, let's say, Osama bin Laden, or the people involved in terrorism, or like the young man who came to my office. They are thoroughly atypical Muslims. They are atypical. So the overwhelming majority of Muslims are either Shia, that's the great majority, or Sunni Muslims. Within Islam, then a minority, probably about 10%, we might call fundamentalist, like the rulers of Iran right now. That's not where the great majority of people in Iran are, in a Shia country, but its rulers are fundamentalist, seeking to basically take Islam back to the Middle Ages. That's the fundamentalists. And to reject any kind of compromise with the modern world, and particularly with the secular world. The Islamists, or the radicals, are a much smaller group beyond that. Those who are politically militant, they are a tiny, tiny proportion, and they come from a teacher from the 18th century in Saudi Arabia, and they are called the Wahhabis. Actually, the government of Saudi Arabia is Wahhabi in its position, but they are not radical or militant. So Osama bin Laden's group, the militants, are a tiny group within that kind of radical Islam. That radical Islam basically says that only the first three centuries of Islam are real Islam. That is, for the first 300 years from the time of Muhammad, from say 600 to 900, 950, Islam spread primarily by the sword across the world, by what is called the jihad, the holy war. Muhammad himself and his followers believe that their religion is the last great revelation from God. They accept that the Bible is part of God's revelation, but that the Quran, which was dictated not by God, because God is so transcendent, he doesn't speak to us, but dictated by an angel to Muhammad, and is written down word for word, and not really translated. You can get translations, but they're not regarded as authoritative. Only the Quran in the original Arabic is considered to be authoritative. But you know, from that beginning, Muhammad believed that this was the true religion, which was to be, God commanded to be spread by the sword across the world. And in those first three centuries, Islam spread a huge distance by conquest, as far as India, to the east, right across North Africa, and up into Spain, to the west. And the radical Islamists, like Osama bin Laden, believe that anything that's happened basically since 950 is corrupt. So, for example, all the beautiful medieval Islamic architecture, which is what you may think of when you think of Islamic culture, they regard as a kind of sinful corruption. Only those first three centuries are genuine. And so for those radicals, they believe that they should overthrow all the Muslim governments there are in the world, including the government of Saudi Arabia, as well as Western governments. They're not simply against us, they're against other Muslims as well. If you probably heard on the news the other day when there were these terrible bombings in Iraq, and this at this Shiite festival, in which 150 people or so died earlier this week. You know, people were saying this was Al-Qaeda that was responsible. Al-Qaeda itself said, no, we're not responsible for it. However, you know, Shia Islam is a heresy, and these people deserve to be killed. That is their attitude, that all other Muslims are basically infidels as well. So it's very important not to think of all Muslims as being like Osama bin Laden, as being militants, as being radicals like that. The radicals are a tiny minority within Islam, and they hate most of Islam. as well as everybody else. They feel they have two callings. One is to cleanse the house of faith, the house of Islam. The other is to convert by force the rest of the world to Islam, to take up the jihad again. But that is very important. So if you meet a Muslim in your neighborhood, don't assume that they're a follower of Osama bin Laden. They probably hate him more passionately than you do. I mean that very seriously. And you need to recognize that. So don't be afraid of somebody. You know, some terrible things happened after 9/11 in Central California. You know, the owner of a grocery store who was Muslim in this little rural community my wife comes from was shot to death by a group of teenagers. You know, and he was no Islamic radical. And for us as Christians, it's particularly important that we understand who people are and don't just lump them all into one group. We don't like it as Christians if everybody assumes that we're responsible, let's say, for all the terrible things that the whole church has done throughout its history. You know, if you're a Christian, you're responsible for the Inquisition. Well, you don't like to be accused of such things. Or you're a Christian and therefore you're guilty of the things that the most extreme groups within evangelical Christianity do. Bombing abortion clinics, for example. Is that who you are? Because you're an evangelical Christian and you don't appreciate it if people assume that about you. So we must treat other people in the way we would like to be treated ourselves, with some respect for who we actually are. So get to know them, and you'll find out that many of them are, that hardly any of them are radical in their views, in fact are passionately opposed to these radical and militant ideas. Okay, any other questions here, just as we think about this diversity here? Yes. I certainly didn't feel so at the time. What I tried to do, he came under compulsion. I said to his mother, if he doesn't want to talk, you can't make him, and I can't talk to somebody who doesn't want to talk to me. But he came somewhat unwillingly, and we chatted, I suppose, for about an hour and a half. What I tried to do, it's obviously very challenging in such a circumstance. The most important thing you can do, of course, is to pray for the person. And you know that God is not limited to this brief time you have with an individual, and I continue to pray for him. And secondly, I left him with some questions to think about. He was tremendously disrespectful to his parents, and I challenged him to think about whether that could possibly be faithful to God, even within Islam, never mind outside it. He was just filled with bitterness and sarcasm and hostility, including for most other Muslims, because I asked him if he went to the local mosque, and he just, his lip curled, and no. I mean, they were just, because they weren't militant, he hated them. And it was very sad to see what had happened to him. I've kept trying to contact him since, but you know, I imagine after 9/11, the family probably had to move, and the telephone number has been changed several times, so I haven't been able to track them down. But I keep praying for him, and I pray that even if he hasn't met any other Christians since, that God will use the questions I asked him to work away at his heart and mind even years later. And that leads me to a very important practical point. We must never think that the conversations we have with people are the sort of only thing that God is ever going to do in somebody's life. That's not the way things are. And when the Apostle Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 3, he says, you know, this is God's harvest field. And he says, we are his fellow laborers. That's a wonderful privilege and a wonderful responsibility. He says, I planted and Apollos watered. It is God who gives the increase. One of the things I challenge our students at Covenant to do is this, is that if they ever in their ministries or in their lives in any way have the possibility at any time to see somebody coming to faith in Christ, that one of the things they need to do is to ask them, what has God been doing in your life to bring you to this stage? You know, tell me your story. If we went around this room, everybody's stories would be different. And when you listen to people's stories, you see how God has used a great diversity of means to bring people to Himself. Often things that happened many, many years before. I'll never forget a young man I met in St. Louis who had just become a Christian at the age of 32. And I asked him to tell me why he had become a Christian. And he said, well, he said, there was really, in my life, there was one Christian who had a huge impact on me, but it was 18 years ago when I was in eighth grade, and it was my school teacher, and she was a Christian, and there were a couple of things about her that I never forgot, you know, that God has now used to bring me to Himself. The one was that she treated, and secondly, she read to us C.S. Lewis's Narnia stories, and I have never forgotten them. And God has used those two things 18 years later to draw me to Himself. When you talk to somebody, don't assume, or when you have a relationship with somebody, that if you don't see them coming to faith right away, that's the end of it. You know, God is very patient and He is very persevering. And He can take seeds that you sowed in somebody's life 20 years ago and bring them to life and to faith much later down the road, either just by themselves or through some other means as well. You know, our whole understanding of evangelism is very shallow. You know, I have this conversation with somebody, if they don't come to faith, well then that's it somehow. I've not done it properly, I've wasted the opportunity. That's not the way God works. If you just think of Jesus as an example, most of the people that Jesus ministered to did not respond and come to faith till after His death and resurrection. He was no failure as an evangelist, I can assure you. He's clearly the greatest evangelist there ever was. Think of all the Pharisees that Jesus spoke to. We're told in the early chapters of Acts that a vast number of Pharisees came to faith. You can be quite sure that almost every one of them had heard Jesus speaking and probably been angry at the time and very critical. Later, many of them came to faith. So it's very important that we don't think of evangelism as something which has to have immediate consequences, immediate results. When we think like that, we're simply betraying that our understanding is shaped by the culture in which we live, which thinks of evangelism as technique and thinks of immediate results as the test of whether anything's worthwhile. But if we just look at our own hearts, we know that that's not true with the Lord. I mean, He takes years of patient love and perseverance and graciousness to draw us to Himself, and then He takes years and years to get us going on the road to sanctification and growth. And we are very slow to respond to His love and to His kindness and to His perseverance. Now, if that's true of us as believers, and many of us took years to come to faith ourselves, it's certainly going to be true of unbelievers as well. You know, when you see somebody come to faith, it's the end result of years of work by God in their life through all sorts of different means. In one sense, becoming a Christian is the beginning, but in the other sense, it's the end result of God's gracious and kind and persevering work over a great many years. And that changes the way, it seems to me, we think about reaching out to the people around us. If God doesn't call me to have results, He calls me to be faithful. But that doesn't let us off the hook. So I have a responsibility, that the New Testament says, to redeem the time and to make the most of every opportunity. My conversation, Paul writes in Colossians 3, is always to be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that I may know how to answer people. So I'm not off the hook, but I have a confidence in the sovereignty of God. But God is the one who wants to save people far more than I do. So that is the missionary's confidence, whether I'm in the other side of the world or right here, that God is in the business of saving people and drawing them to Christ, and He calls me to be His fellow laborer in that task. And what that requires is faithfulness of life, faithfulness of conversation, and faithfulness of prayer.